Plan Commission meeting for January the 19th to order. We have a roll call, please.
Commissioner Fowler Payne. Commissioner Mack. Commissioner Martin.
Here.
Vice Chair Keane.
Here. You join me in the flag salute? Agenda review. Does anybody want to revise the order of any of the items on tonight's agenda? Little green lights on.
I move that we reorganize the agenda of Verizon applicants not here and maybe switch 8B and 8A.
That sounds fine by me.
That's fine with me.
Fine.
Okay. Community comments and suggestions. Anybody in the audience would like to address the commission on anything that's not on tonight's agenda? Now is your chance. Since I see nobody in the audience, I'll move on to written communications.
There's none this evening.
Okay, thank you. Consent agenda. Approval of minutes for January or December 1st and July 5th. On December 1st minutes, is there any additions or corrections?
No.
None.
Okay.
So move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
For the minutes for January 5th, is there any additions or corrections that anybody needs to make or would like to make?
No.
None.
Move for approval.
So move.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Okay. Next is public hearing. AA is the Verizon permit that we just moved to 8B, and unless there's, we need to move it on to 9. So we'll hear 8B.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Keene, and the rest of the commissioners. Tonight, we are looking at the draft housing element update and a development code for emergency shelters. As a brief overview, the housing element is one of the 7 required elements of the general plan that provides a strategy for meeting housing needs of various income levels within the city. The State Department of Housing and Community Development, or HCD, is responsible for reviewing and certifying the housing element. More specifically, the purpose of the housing element is to increase the supply of housing that is equitable for families of all income categories, with an emphasis on infill development. On a regional level, the purpose of the housing element is to provide greater opportunities for residents to live closer to where they work. The housing element contains information about the needs assessment, which means the city's fair share of the regional housing need as determined by the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, an analysis of the city's resources to aid housing development, which includes land availability, infrastructure, and financial resources, an analysis of constraints to housing development, including those imposed by the city in the form of regulations or environmental constraints, a review of how well the city implemented the previous housing element update, and then finally, the policy program, which is the core of the document that explains how we intend to meet our goals, providing sufficient housing according to our needs assessment. The document is organized with the goals, policies, and programs near the front, since this information is basically our action plan. The remaining chapters provide more of the background and supporting information, including demographics, housing characteristics, housing affordability, special housing needs groups, at-risk housing units, housing resources, housing constraints, and review of the previous housing element. And this slide shows Aurora Grande's, what's called its fair share of the anticipated future housing demand. These numbers initially come from HCD from the whole county, or for the whole county, and are further refined by the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments based on a formula that considers population, income, employment, and vacancy factors. Each city is required to update their housing element to accommodate adequate general plan and zoning capacity for their respective allocation by the income category. So note that these units are not required to be built, but rather the housing element is just to show that the city has plans to be able to accommodate what that allocation is. During the last cycle, we were required to accommodate a total of 362 units. The distribution of 242 units in this particular update cycle represents a 33% reduction. And if you don't mind, I'm going to take my coat off. So as I mentioned, the goals, policies, and programs create the action plan of the housing element. Because most of the goals, policies, and programs from the previous cycle are still appropriate, they have been retained. Several policies and programs have either been added or revised for clarity purposes since the previous housing element update, as shown in this slide, and the next few slides. And these include establishing a program to provide assistance for first-time homebuyers, monitoring the loss of permanent workforce housing from vacation rentals, amending the zoning ordinance to encourage farm worker housing, and amending the development code to define transitional and supportive housing as allowable residential uses. Program G1-3, this was amended in response to City Council comments from the previous housing element update. This program previously stated that the city shall amend the development code to allow development of five or more multiple family attached units in the MF and MFA zoning districts with a minor use permit. The intent of this program is to remove obstacles to the provision of multifamily housing. Council was concerned about not having any oversight over the design of large multifamily housing projects. Staff has therefore modified this program to state, as you can see on the slide, the city shall amend the development code to allow development of up to 15 multifamily attached units in the MF and MFA zoning districts with a minor use permit, subject to design review through the Architectural Review Committee. Development of over 15 multiple family attached units in the MF and MFA zoning districts shall require a conditional use permit. The Planning Commission held a workshop to review the draft housing element in September 2014 and provided several comments as shown on this particular slide. All of these have been included in the updated document. The City Council considered the draft document later on that month, and they did not have any changes. After submitting the draft housing element to HCD last year, The agency responded with additional city actions that must occur prior to document certification. And these include implementing program K2-1 regarding emergency shelters, implementing program K2-2 regarding transitional and supportive housing, and including a program that increases the allowable density in the office mixed-use zoning district from 15 to 20 dwelling units per acre for standalone multifamily housing projects with a minor use permit. This addresses the issue of reducing government constraints that HCD had commented on. And then finally, to ensure that there is adequate opportunity for public participation throughout the update process. So the housing element has been amended to include this information, and the proposed draft ordinance before you tonight implements programs K2-1 and K2-2. To provide more opportunities for public participation, there will be at least 3 public hearings on the draft housing element update. All interested parties and agencies will be encouraged to provide comments, and all of those comments will then be transmitted to HCD. Regarding the proposed ordinance to include provisions for emergency shelters and transitional and supportive housing, staff proposes to add definitions, amend the use tables, and include some development standards. So starting with definitions, these are all from state government code. Emergency shelters are defined as housing with minimal supportive services for homeless persons that is limited to occupancy of 6 months or less by a homeless person. No individual or household may be denied emergency shelter because of an inability to pay. Supportive housing means housing with no limit on length of stay that is occupied by the target population and that is linked to on-site or off-site service that assists the supportive housing resident in retaining the housing, improving his or her health status, and maximizing his or her ability to live and, when possible, work in the community. Supportive housing shall be considered a residential use of property and shall be subject only to those restrictions that apply to other residential dwellings in the same type of zone. Target population means persons with low incomes who have one or more disabilities, including mental illness, HIV or AIDS, substance abuse, or other chronic health condition, and may include adults, emancipated minors, families with children, elderly persons, young adults aging out of the foster care system, individuals exiting from institutional settings, veterans, and homeless people. And finally, transitional housing means a building or buildings configured as rental housing developments, but operated under program requirements that require the termination of assistance or recirculation of the assisted unit in order assisted unit to another eligible person recipient at a predetermined future point in time that shall be no less than 6 months from the beginning of the assistance. Transitional housing shall be considered a residential use of property and shall be subject to only those restrictions that apply to other residential dwellings in the same type in that zone. Transitional housing does not include state-licensed residential care facilities. So we have one of these in our city, and it's on 203 Bridge Street. As discussed in the staff report, it is proposed that emergency shelters be allowed in the industrial mixed-use and the highway mixed-use zoning districts with a minor use permit. Therefore, the use table would be amended as shown on this slide. And it is also proposed that transitional and supportive housing be permitted in all residential districts, and this is to be consistent with state law. And state law also allows cities to impose development standards in our regulations for emergency shelters. Staff proposes that standards regulating the following issues be considered. So I'm going to read these off. I'm not going to say everything that's on all of these slides. We could always go back to them. But number of persons and parking, those issues would be determined how many beds and how many parking spaces. On-site, let's see, where am I? To go back. Sorry. Okay, so number of people, parking, oops. Slide 19. So yeah, exterior lighting, and this is for security, and then more provisions regarding security. This is a long one, but it's all dealing with on-site management. So there's lots of details about that. And waiting and intake areas, laundry facilities, refuse enclosures, common facilities are allowed, outdoor activities are allowed with time limitations. And then facility location. And so this is important. I'll just read this one. Emergency shelters shall not be located within 300 feet of another emergency shelter, kindergarten through 12th grade, curriculum school, child care center, or park as measured from the closest property line. So what this translates into is what you can see here, that 300-foot buffer next to the school there off of, what I want to say is there's 9 acres basically that's taken out of the IMU zoning district because of the school that's up there. So that means that basically the only place that an emergency shelter could be placed within the IMU zoning district would be along El Camino Real. However, it does not have any impact whatsoever to the highway mixed-use zoning district. So in other words, there's no parks, there's no schools or anything next to the HMU zoning district to have this kind of an impact. It's only the IMU zoning district. So in summary, the housing element provides the necessary conditions for producing and preserving an adequate supply of affordable housing, including special needs housing. It includes strategies that address the city's local housing needs, including an inventory of land adequately zoned for housing in all income categories, and a commitment to assist in housing development through regulatory concessions and incentives. State law requires jurisdictions to make a diligent effort to involve all economic segments of the community and the housing element update process. The public hearing process provides an opportunity for the public to identify problems and propose solutions to housing issues that face the city today. By submitting the housing element to HCD, the city will be in compliance with statutory procedure for adoption of an updated housing element. A certified housing element also makes the city eligible for state and federal funding for various types of housing programs. It should be noted that some of the policies identified encourage increased densities for infill sites and therefore could result in parking or other neighborhood issues related to future proposed projects. However, development of housing at maximum densities is not a requirement and all projects are subject to CEQA. So to conclude, staff recommends that the Planning Commission do 3 things. Review and receive public comment on the draft housing element. Consider proposed amendments to portions of Title 16 of the Municipal Code to allow emergency shelters as a permitted use in the IMU and HMU zoning districts pursuant to Housing Program Element, to Housing Element Program K2-1 and define supportive and transitional housing as residential uses subject to the same standards that apply to other housing in the same zone pursuant to Housing Element Program K2-2. And then finally, continue this item to March 1st to consider final recommendations to City Council. I'm done. Be happy to answer questions.
John, do you have any questions to staff?
Why is the emergency shelter being restricted to only, I think it was 34 persons?
That is something that we saw in the development code for convalescent care in our, that exists right now, where it can go up to 34 beds. So it was the only thing that we saw in there that was relatively similar to what this is.
I guess because if it's a true emergency, I would think you wouldn't want to close your doors to someone who's really in need, or say, you know, what the next one's like a mile and a half across town, and then how do they get there sort of thing. So yeah. I'm just wondering how that...
Yeah, it's consistent with what Morro Bay has, but it's completely up for discussion.
I would add, so we did make some comparison to other similar-sized cities, and that's sort of the realm that fell in. And remember, this is something that would be approved without besides a minor staff checklist, without discretionary hearings or permits. It would be just, it would be simply allowed in these zones. And so within the provisions of state law, we are allowed to put some limitations on the use and the structure so that, you know, we had an idea of what, you know, what that ultimate shelter may be should it come forward, should an entity come forward and want that to be built and permitted.
And I can also mention that if we did have a limit, say it was 34, and somebody wanted to come in with a shelter that provided for additional beds, I think that might be a conditional use permit. Then we'd be able to look at that through the discretionary process.
So there is a vehicle to go larger. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. Just along those same lines, we keep hearing in the news all the time about these warming stations. How does that work in, or does it even have anything to do with the emergency shelters?
They are different. We look at the emergency shelter as, say, like Prado Road in San Luis Obispo, and a warming shelter is a temporary situation, so it would be issued through a temporary use permit. So, in other words, if a church wanted to have a warming shelter, we would address that through the temporary use permit process.
Thank you.
Is that what's considered at St. Barnabas? Are they still doing that warming shelter there?
Right now, there's the warming shelter that's at the county building on Grand Avenue, social services building. And they're doing that for one more year for this winter. And we do anticipate that they will be submitting, they meaning the five cities homeless coalition, submitting a temporary use permit for a local church. And St. Barnabas, we looked at that for overnight parking. Remember, we tried that as a pilot program. And we only got there were a lot of restrictions on that. We only had a couple of participants, and the church was the one that didn't pursue it.
Glenn, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. I guess I'm concerned a little bit and curious a little bit. When you look down here, there are three options for us. And the first one is review and receive public comment. And other than an applicant for another item on the agenda, there is no one from the public. I'm concerned that the public workshop took place 16 months ago, and then it looks like, you know, then the public hearing on the City Council, all these dates are 2014. Did we just hear from HCD? This seems like kind of a delay between September of 2014 when this received public input and today. There's a part of me that is strongly motivated to continue the item, in order to give the public a little more opportunity to get some updated comment, you know, before we make any recommendation.
Yeah, thank you. Very good comments. Our concern was the same. It was rolled out a while ago in HCD land for a while, came back. Staff had to await a timing where we could make all the changes and review all and analyze HCD comments, which we have. And instead of asking for a recommendation from you tonight, we are indeed requesting just to roll it out again, remind us all what's in the document, a very important policy document for the city. Although we did the usual noticing, we'll do some additional outreach and bring it to you again, or the recommendation is for you to continue it to the March 1st hearing. That'll allow us to enable us to do some additional outreach. Tonight's hearing provides an opportunity just to walk the commission through it, and anybody who may be watching and interested, think about the policies that are existing from before, the new policies, HCD comments, and then provide some time for you to go through it further and anybody to provide input.
And I will add that I sent all of the documents that the Planning Commission received for this evening's meeting to the Five Cities Homeless Coalition for them to review directly. So
the three public hearings that you were referencing to in your presentation are the ones that were already done in 2015?
No, the three would be the one tonight, the one for March 1st, and then the one for the City Council.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, unless it's premature, I'd like to move that we continue this item to a date certain of March 1st.
It is a little premature because I'd like to open it to the public.
Okay. Sure.
And then I understand.
Okay.
It's a formality.
That's fine. Go.
And then after they have a chance, then we'll maybe have a couple more questions or comments, and then move it on.
It's fine.
Okay. Terry, do you have anything else?
No.
Any questions of staff?
No.
Okay. At this time, I'd like to open it to the public for comment. Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing and bring it back to the commission. Is there any other comments that you'd like to make? I someplace in the document, I saw that one of the things of the siting of the shelter should be close to shopping and bus stops and all that. And the area that we are proposing that is legally for them over on El Camino Real doesn't fit in any of those qualifications. So I was wondering how we justify that or get around it.
Well, we do not have to limit it to the IMU and HMU zoning districts. If it is something that the Planning Commission would like to consider for, you know, inserting into the document other zoning districts, then we can certainly entertain that.
The IMU and the Industrial Mixed Use District and the Highway Mixed Use District, they do provide some underutilized land. The Highway Mixed Use District is a mixed use district on Grand and partially on Grand that is somewhat proximate to the commercial corridor. El Camino, of course, has the park and ride facilities there. So we, you know, it's not the perfect fit. I don't think we're going to get the perfect fit, but it does provide some opportunities. But if the commission wants to direct us to look at some other opportunities in the city, you know, that may, if not be considered compatible, be available to be located or have a shelter located there, we'd be happy to do that.
That actually wasn't my goal to change it, but I wanted to make sure that we didn't have something in here that was a requirement that we couldn't meet for the state. And that was the reason I brought that up. John, do you have another comment?
Well, I was noticing the exact same thing staff had pointed out, is it's only allowed in the IMU
and HMU.
And the HMU.
Right.
And you know, kind of what I like to do is kind of reverse engineer it and kind of, you know, draw some circles around the shopping areas and those bus terminals and see what kind of designations are there and see if we don't have to maybe amend and add one more designation to make it more usable. It doesn't seem to be fitting.
Okay. Any other comments? I just got one comment, and it's about the public showing up and the amount of time that it takes. When we first did this element, it took, I'm going to say, years of back and forth to the state. Every time we'd do it and send it in, they'd revise it, and then we'd fix the revisions and send it, and they would send it back. And it took several months for them to get to it and send it back to us. So I think that's one of the reasons that we've got things going on clear back in 14. It just takes forever to get these things wordsmithed for them. Okay. I entertain a motion to continue this. Oh, sorry.
I just have one question. When was the last housing element update? What year was that?
2013.
2013.
Mm-hmm.
So it hasn't been
very long. No, that's why in my comments, you know, not many of them have changed. You know, they're still relevant policies and programs. We're mostly addressing what HCD would like to see. And, you know, their comment was, hey, you need to start implementing some of these, hence the development code amendment. So.
Okay, perfect.
I entertain a motion for continuance.
So moved.
Second. Could we have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Martin?
Yes.
Vice Chair Keane?
Yes.
Commissioner Fallow Payne?
Yes.
Commissioner Mack?
Yes.
Okay, moving on to first public hearing, 8A, please.
Okay, this is a permit by Verizon to establish a telecommunication facility on Huebner Lane. So the project site is located at the end of Huebner Lane, which is off of Branch Mill Road, and it's located within the public facility zoning district on property that is owned by the city. The site is developed with a water tank and is surrounded by St. Barnabas Church to the west, vacant land to the south, active agricultural land to the east, and then residential development to the north. At this time, both Sprint and T-Mobile have antennas on this water tank. AT&T recently decommissioned its facility at this location, and Verizon proposes to locate its facility in place of AT&T equipment with antennas that are mounted on the side of the tank. Specifically, Verizon proposes to install the following, as you can see on the screen there. 9 panel antennas that are flush mounted on the tank using what's called the Magna Mount system, which means that they are attached magnetically instead of permanently attached to the tank. 9 remote radio units on the tank, 5 ray caps, 3 of which would be on the tank, and then 2 would be in the equipment shelter. An electric meter, a generator, and then Verizon would use the existing conduit vacated by AT&T, and then also use the existing equipment shelter, which was owned by AT&T and now is owned by the city. The city and Verizon would share this shelter, and the project is conditioned to include an expandable metal wall between the two equipment areas for ventilation purposes. The purpose of the facility is to allow greater capacity for Verizon to better handle phone calls, data megabytes, the total number of active users in the area, and also to support the rapid growth of 4G data used within the city. 4G refers to fourth generation of data technology for cellular networks. The 4G network also carries 911 calls and is used in support of police and fire emergency response. The future operation of this facility will comply with the Federal Communications Commission guidelines limiting public exposure to radio frequency energy. And as this slide shows, the project will have minimal visual impact to the surrounding area, especially since Verizon antennas will replace the AT&T antennas at this same spot and will be flush mounted instead of on top of the tank. So the AT&T antennas used to be on top and more visible. Now they will be, for Verizon, much less visible. However, the conditions have been added that are intended to make sure that the project blends with the existing area with little to no visual impact. These have been added to the resolution and include that all equipment placed on the water tank shall be painted to match the color of the tank. The facility shall have subdued colors and non-reflective materials, which blend with the materials and colors of the surrounding area. The facility shall not bear any signs or advertising devices other than certification, warning, or other required seals or signage. All accessory equipment associated with the operation of the wireless facility shall be located within a building, enclosure, or underground vault that complies with the development standards of the public facility zoning district. The city adopted telecommunication facility siting and permit submittal requirements in 2001, which are included in your packet. Applicants must include all information related to the site conditions, technology, radio frequency, exposure, co-location opportunities, visual impact assessment, and antenna and site capacity information. The application package for this project included most of this information or was ascertained during the staff advisory committee meeting. The project is consistent with these particular guidelines, and so in conclusion, staff recommends that the Planning Commission adopt a resolution approving the project subject to the conditions of approval. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Terry, do you have any questions of staff?
Yeah. Looking at the overall map, does the Homeowners Association own that parcel where the trees or the grove of trees is located? Have they been notified about, no one's here, but.
Yeah, everybody within 300 feet of the property line has been notified.
But that parcel does belong to the Homeowners Association that's adjacent to it?
Oops. So are you talking about?
The open space parcel behind, well, whatever that street is.
So over here on the screen? Over here?
Yeah, between where the project location is and the residential.
Yes, that would be the HOA, and they would have been notified. They're well within the 300-foot radius.
Do they currently have an easement to go through there? Or is that something they're going to have to acquire?
No, there already is a public utility easement all along Huebner Lane, okay. And so therefore that's how all the other utilities were able to get their facilities at the tank. So
they don't have to require anything else?
Yeah.
Is it inappropriate or appropriate to ask what the lease agreement is?
The lease agreement is currently being negotiated between the representatives of Verizon and our city attorney's office, and that will later go to the city council after the entitlement is secured for this conditional use permit. And I believe that they are looking at several different locations within the city and renegotiating all of the leases that Verizon has in the city. So they're kind of talking about a lot of different issues at this point. So.
That's all I have.
I've only got one question, and it may be more toward the applicant than the city, but I'm just kind of curious. The four bullets on our sheet here, talking about the conditions, and then there's a paragraph after that. It says it is expected that routine maintenance and inspection of the facility will occur on a monthly basis. Now, I look at this thing and seem it's fairly static. Is monthly, is that going to be a condition, or is that just kind of a practice? I would think that even, maybe quarterly is going to be adequate. I don't, I'm not trying to burden the applicant unnecessarily if they don't need to be, but I'm also not trying to recreate or redefine, some of the standard maintenance requirements and some of these other leases that we have.
Yeah, that's basically just to say that, hey, there's not going to be somebody coming up there all the time.
Right.
It's just, it could be once a month. It could be longer durations. It just depends on what is necessary for that particular facility. But, yeah, I would ask the applicant's representative to clarify how often they believe they'd be going up there.
And obviously we will have emergency contacts, if there's weather conditions or other conditions that create an emergency they're going to get fairly immediate or prompt response given the, situation.
Yeah, and the city does have an opportunity to utilize the generator that's up there, too, for its equipment. So it is kind of a win-win for the city.
Very good. Thank you.
John, any comments? Questions?
My question, that's predominantly a city tank, correct? And the city takes care of that tank and periodically, every 4 or 5 years, it gets repainted, possibly.
It is scheduled to be painted. We're not sure if it's going to be this fiscal year, but it is in the capital improvement program to paint this tank.
Well, I guess my only concern that I raise is if, obviously, it's easier to paint a tank if there's nothing attached to it. I'm just wondering who's bearing the expense of having to pull the equipment off and then coordinating that equipment coming off to repaint the tank. That's not necessarily something the city should be.
No, the carriers are responsible for removing their own equipment when it comes time to paint the tank. Yes, that's explained in the lease agreement that goes to the council.
So and I didn't know whether we needed a condition addressing that. But if it's in the lease agreement,
it's in the lease agreement.
Okay,
yeah.
That answers the question. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll ask the applicant to come forward and have any comments.
Good evening. Tricia Knight representing Verizon Wireless this evening. Let's see, to answer your question, in all honesty, they probably only go up there maybe once a year or in the event of an emergency. Truly, it is unmanned. But they ask us to go ahead and permit the allowance for once a month in the event that technology changes, and that should be needed. But it truly is, once it's online, it's pretty much unmanned. There's usually not too many times we have to get up there. And then I'm available to answer any other questions that you might have.
Excuse me. You understood my question, right, regarding the equipment, and that's in a lease agreement, or if we needed to repaint the tank, that
yes, and I believe we sort of worked through some of those issues through the permit process too to make sure that's included in the lease, that it's at our expense, and notification processes and that sort of thing. So I think we're okay. We knew that was coming down the pipeline anyway, luckily enough. So
okay. I have one question. How long will the installation take?
I would say on average from start to finish is about 3 weeks by the time they get everything mobilized, all the equipment up there, get it tuned, and do all the things that they need to do from an engineering standpoint. So about 3 weeks.
I noticed that in the pictures, the renderings, there's no indication of which direction the wires go from the antenna down. Do they go down the side of the tank, or they go up on top and then over?
They go down the side of the tank on cable trays and then underground from the tank at the bottom of the tank to the equipment area.
Will there be one at each one of those three sites, cable tray going down?
Yes, there will.
Okay.
Yes.
It's just...
They'll be painted to match the water tank, so it will blend in quite nicely.
Okay. I think that's it. Mm-hmm. Anybody else in the audience like to speak on this matter? Just one comment about the maintenance. I've been involved in several of these kind of operations, not necessarily with Verizon, but any place that there's a generator that is for emergency, they generally once a month check and make sure that thing's going to operate at the time. And that's probably what the monthly thing is. I notice on a lot of the SCADA systems that the city has and all that, with the maintenance schedule for the generators is at least once a month.
This might be a question for the city, but how often is that tank checked or maintained by the city? The water, is there somebody that goes up there weekly or monthly, or how often do they go up and check on the tank?
Well,
yeah, that's a question for Public Works.
I really don't know. I think it's just a matter of they have their routine things that they do for all the water tanks to make sure that I know that they do a lot of that remotely. So I don't really know the answer to that, how often they get up there. Good question, though.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
I have none.
Can I entertain a motion?
I move that the Planning Commission approve a resolution of the Commission of the City of Aurora Grande approving conditional use permit 15-02 applied for by Verizon Wireless located on Huebner Lane.
I'll second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Any more further discussion? Can we have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Martin?
Yes.
Commissioner Mack?
Yes.
Commissioner Fowler Payne?
Yes.
Vice Chair Keen?
Yes. Okay, we'll move on to non-public hearing items. The staff report on the review of parking standards.
Good evening, Vice Chair Keene, members of the Commission. Tonight, the non-public hearing item on the agenda is Staff Project 15-011, which is review of the parking standards. So if you remember in last year, the Planning Commission requested staff to bring forward a discussion on the city's parking standards. And so that's what we're here doing tonight. We wanted to go over some of the existing general plan policies that help guide us when we're looking to update any of the municipal code language, which is attachment 2 in your staff report. Staff went through those, and basically these are all policies that either address parking specifically in terms of where it's either to be located or in a indirect kind of way, such as reduction of parking for in order to incentivize affordable housing. So when looking at these policies, staff kind of found that they fell into three different themes, those being concentrating parking to maximize land use efficiency, preserving visual aesthetics. So a lot of those, you know, parking is encouraged to be located behind buildings or to the side of buildings so that we don't have the sea of parking in front of buildings. And thirdly, ensuring adequate supply. And these were found in four different general plan elements, so the circulation element, the economic development element, housing, and land use elements. Two of the policies were also found in the city's climate action plan, which is a general plan document adopted by reference. And staff wanted to go over the anticipated project schedule for this work effort. So at tonight's meeting, we were looking at the initial parking standards introduction and getting some further discussion and direction from the Planning Commission. On February 16th, we tentatively identified that as being a night to review some of the data that's been collected that we've had community development staff go out and collect, as well as reporting on our field observations, and then coming back in March with an actual review of parking survey data that we would do in-house. And then lastly, on April 5th, looking at an analysis of potential changes to the parking standards and different impacts associated with those changes. And I wanted to go over parking studies real quick. Parking studies can be customized depending on what exactly city is looking for to get out of this, but they typically follow a general format, which is doing a survey of the stakeholders. This could include patrons, it could include business owners, it could include property owners, that sort of thing. Then looking at an inventory of existing parking. So this could be on a site-per-site basis. It could be for a zoning district itself, and actually looking at the number of spaces currently on the ground. Then we do vehicle counts. These are done in two different ways, either with an in-and-out survey, which monitors the number of cars every X number of intervals, determining how many cars go in, out, and then the operating efficiency of that parking lot. You can also do it by actual license plate survey, going through and looking at the specific parking spaces on an interval basis, recording which cars are still the same cars, which cars are not. This is much more labor-intensive, but you do get a little bit more quantifiable data out of it. And then lastly, taking a look at those vehicle counts and comparing them against the land use demand in the area, so what uses are there, trying to divvy up where people seem to be going and which uses are demanding more parking. And those all come in a range of costs. If you were to go to an outside consultant, they range anywhere from $25,000, upwards of $100,000 plus. We are proposing to do this in-house using community development staff, but it will be a work effort depending on which direction we end up going. So that's the gist of my report tonight. Really, it's an opportunity for the Planning Commission to review the city policies related to parking and provide further direction to staff in terms of are we concerned about parking for specific uses, specific locations, specific areas of the city? Is it commercial uses? Is it residential uses? Is it the mixed use uses, or that sort of thing? So we're looking for a little bit more clarification from the Planning Commission on that to help guide our work effort moving forward. So I'm more than happy to answer any questions and help facilitate the discussion.
Thank you. Because I've got the mic, and I'm the assistant chair tonight, I'd like to make a comment about this. It was everybody's has a lot of comments about it, from the staff, commission, city, people that drive around town and have to park. And every project that comes through here, we make sure that they have the exact number of parking spaces that are required for that project. Now then, if we go around town and look at all these projects we've done, we've got a disaster. Not one of them, even though they got exactly the number of spots that they were required, there's not enough parking to them. And I'm not talking just about commercial. I'm talking about residential, PUDs, the whole gamut, because we're proving things legally that are not adequate. And that's my personal goal. I don't know about the rest of the commission, is to try to correct some of this. It's just, we've had these policies about, if you limit the number of spots, people get on buses or walk or bicycles or everything. This community just did not embrace that. And it's caused us a lot of headaches, in my estimation. So with that, that's my goal, is to try to correct some of this and make it easier for people to shop, easier for the merchants to have people come to shop, because I think they're getting punished just as much as the people looking for parking spots. And I think we need to correct that. Thank you. John, do you have any comments or questions of staff?
No questions. I agree with everything you said. I'm not sure it's the full gamut. I see some residential uses working. I just like to throw out the areas that I know are areas of concern. And we've discussed this before, and I've agreed with Planning Commission in the past when reviewing parking, that it's not necessarily looking at a residence. It's looking at how many bedrooms. And I thought that was a very valid point. The more bedrooms you have, the more opportunity you have for adult children to have their cars and to have more cars associated with that residential unit. So I see that that needs to be looked at and focused on, no matter what kind of residential unit, whether it's an affordable unit or a very high-priced unit. I think it has to do with how many bedrooms you have. Commercial, we're really deficient in commercial. And largely because we let projects come forward that takes the least amount of parking calculation for commercial use, when in reality, a certain percentage of that commercial building becomes restaurant use or food service use over time. And we've all seen it. When a building gets built, the first tenant comes in, that tenant is going to roll over 2 to 4 years. They don't stay in there 15, 20, 30, 40 years. So we really need to look at a percentage of a commercial building becoming more of an intense use and park and have a requirement for these building operators or building owners to park for a more intense use, which is reality. And then restaurants, right off the bat, we have a very deficient way we determine parking, and it doesn't align with building codes. And I'm just going to throw something out here. I copied section of a building code here. It's table 10.4.12. And the way the fire department, the way the building department looks at it is they give you a maximum occupancy for a building. And many times these buildings are maxed out occupied. If it's a successful business, it's going to be full occupancy. But yet we're not parking it for the full occupancy of the building. I just give you a number here, just for discussion. Unconcentrated tables and chairs, in other words, tables and chairs that can move around, they give you one occupant for 15 square feet. If they're standing space, or you know, like bar stools or whatever, it's one occupant for every 5 square feet. So when I start seeing parking standards that are one for every 250 square feet, I mean, we need to come to reality on that. And those are where I see deficiencies in our parking standards. And I don't know if we want to go through a $10,000 to $25,000 or $100,000 study to study everything. I'm more of a firm believer of looking at the problem areas and directing staff on studying the problem areas and not necessarily a broad spectrum of the whole parking code. But I think we should give them direction on where we are deficient.
Yeah, the comments I have are, for me, the focal point would be these higher density residential projects where we have, I'm going to say less than standard, or certainly, you know, where these individual property parcels are 2,500 square feet or 3,500 square feet, you know, much like the most recent project on Cortland that we were reviewing. to me, is these higher density, whether it's, you know, we end up counting number of bedrooms or square footage or whatever it may be. You know, that for me is probably the highest priority, because there are two or three other fairly recent developments, you know, around the city where we have this higher density, you know, residential construction and projects that may have 10, 12 or a dozen, you know, two dozen, you know, structures in them. And it's more than anecdotal that there's a large number of vehicles parked on the street, you know, that are related to these, you know, properties rather than, you know, on the properties or inside, you know, within those developments. That's really my primary, would be my primary focus. I certainly agree that commercially there can be a wide range, and there are commercial developments that have, you know, fewer parking spaces than they really need. From my perspective, that's a lower priority. I'm not disagreeing that there are issues, but for me, the higher priority are these newer, you know, higher density residential projects. And frankly, I expect, you know, the majority of these residential developments that we see this year as they come forward to our commission are going to be the types of developments that have a higher number of structures and a smaller, you know, square footage, you know, properties, and whether the streets are part of an HOA or they're, you know, city mandated or alleys. That's where I just see that's going to be the real barrier, the issue that we're going to be needing to really deal with. And I agree. I would hope we would not start, you know, spending $25,000 to $100,000 on convoluted studies. For myself, I would just like a little bit more opportunity to go through and see how the criteria is written today, and maybe some of it we just need to modernize, because we have a higher percentage of our you know, residential decisions are on this newer style housing development rather than, you know, gee, we've got this 10-acre parcel and we want to bring in 7,000 square foot lots and bring in SFRs. That ain't going to happen. you know, and that's not the type of stuff that we see. So part of it may be just, you know, modernizing, you know, in particular the residential, but maybe the, you know, parking criteria and all. But I'd like a little more time just to review what we really have, work with staff as we go through and try to highlight some of that stuff. But hopefully that helps.
If I can interject on that a little bit.
Sure.
I just use the, you know, the bedroom count, you know, to get more parking. That's one solution. But I guess what I didn't share was what I see the problem. And I've been seeing these PUDs come forward that don't have adequate parking. And largely because they're calling the driveway a street, but yet you can't park on either side. It's a fire lane. It's red striped. So where does all this overflow parking go? Well, it starts affecting the neighbors down the street or the next project down the street, because they're parking on a public street and then walking into their development. So somehow we need to adjust our wordage for the times of today of some of these creative designs that are coming forward, to have them provide adequate parking on site, or in lieu and pick up another property down or next to the project and park it next door and have adequate for it. It's the PUDs. You know, you can't compare it to a single family residence because they have at least an 18-foot driveway and you can park two cars in front of the garage door. Well, what happens when a project comes before us and you can't do that? What mechanisms are we going to give to the designer to tell him, no, you're still deficient?
Maybe reducing the density. I'm just commenting on his. you know, I was in two meetings this week, and it had to do with commercial development. And that was part of the topic, was the parking issues. And so it's not just residential. And so those two items are coming forward to us. And I can already see, and there were comments from the merchants adjacent to it where they're already having to park on the street and it's inadequate, yet they're approving more. So actually, I don't know how they're going to resolve those. And the other thing, when I read through all the parking standards in attachment 2 on the LUE and the LUE, and it was 6-9.4, that specifically says that the on commercial that the parking should be in the rear. And yet, one of the projects that came forward through one of the commissions this week didn't acknowledge that. But I don't remember if there was a, I know they're doing a development plan, did they have to ask for an exception or a variance? I didn't hear those, either one of those avenues discussed in that meeting, because it isn't meeting the land use element. So, and you don't have to comment on it. Those are just my comments on that. But so the parking situation isn't just residential. It's in the commercial, absolutely, industrial, too. I mean, you can go down El Camino, and you see those businesses there, and then there's a line of cars, you know, parked along the chain link fence, and so it's everywhere. So we really do need to, if we're not going to change this, we really need to start evaluating the size of those projects and either reduce the size of the projects or, you know, require them to have more parking, and, you know. That's it. That's all I have to say.
You can go right on Cortland and to the self-help housing project and see how Cortland has been street parked, because there's not enough parking for the amount of units there. So, you know, to me it runs the whole gamut. My intention is not to pick on anything, but to try to get an equitable solution to what I consider a big problem. And I know in commercial, the more parking spots you have, the smaller the building has to be, or will be. And that's not my goal at all, is to try to shrink the buildings, because they need the floor space or they wouldn't be building it. So we just need some kind of we just need to do something. I don't know what it's going to be. We need to do something. And these small lots, we have in there that they need 2 parking spots, and we let them use their garage and put the garage right on the street. That's just a policy that doesn't work, because people do not put their cars in their garage after a period of time. So what do they have to do? They have to go out on the street and park. So when we approve a project that doesn't have uncovered parking for residential, we're making a mistake. And we need to try to figure out a solution to stop that. One of the policies that you referred to, Matt, that C4 1.3, says they get reduced parking requirements if they're within a quarter of a mile of a transit thing. Now that's one of the kind of things that we need to correct, because people aren't using the transit system. So why do we give them a benefit of less parking when it's not going to work? It hasn't worked. So policies like that, and as long as we have that policy, a developer has every entitlement to ask for that condition. And those are the kind of things that I see that are impacting our parking problems. I guess I've said enough. Is there any other comments? Go ahead.
If I'm going to get back on what you were saying, is there, like you were saying, that CT4 1.3, can you eliminate that? I mean, can that be just eliminated from our general plan so that they're not getting the allowance for the reduced parking?
We would have to make a recommendation to City Council, and they would make that policy decision.
But that is an avenue where we can remove that.
There's another one on the next page, U5 11.4, basically says the same kind of thing. And so I think we just need to kind of look at some of the exceptions that we're making to these developments that are legally in our code, but really defeat the purpose of having adequate parking. And I want to also, I want to have everybody have, and myself, a better understanding of this shared parking policies. They come up all the time, and it seems like that in some places they're perfectly valid, and some places that they just don't work.
Are you referring to a mixed-use reduction? Or what do you mean shared parking?
Like where Figueroa Mountain is,
okay.
Having them share parking with other things. I don't know that's a problem. That was just an example I thought of real quick. And the shopping center where CVS is, we've got all those businesses in there, shared parking, and I just want to make sure that those formulas are actually working for what we have, how we intended them to, or supposed that they would have worked. I don't know that that's a problem. I just want to make sure that we all understand that.
No, each business needs to operate on its own with its own parking. And I think it's real clear on asking for a mixed-use reduction. I mean, you really have to show, and they have to demonstrate different hours of operation to allow that reduction to occur. I think what's kind of happened maybe in the past is maybe they've been granted those mixed-use reduction and haven't demonstrated that because they all have the same business hours.
Yeah, and the business could have changed, like you were referring to before.
Well, another item on there was D1, where the city shall relax the parking standards for apartments containing extremely very low to low moderate and senior housing. But there's hardly any household, if you've got a married couple, who doesn't have two cars. So how do you reduce or relax the parking standards and yet, you know, you've already eliminated the minimum amount of parking spaces that you need for those units?
I'll go ahead and provide some comments and feel free to, this is a staff item and certainly a work in progress and interested in some back and forth discussion here. So, your conversation is not that dissimilar to conversations and staff and trying us, looking at and evaluating the parking standards and issues and case studies with developments. And certainly what I'm hearing is that a primary focus, maybe the primary focus, is a small lot residential development that we've been seeing in recent years, with also a good hard look at perhaps some of our commercial corridors and maybe leaving the larger lot, single-family residential districts to another time or a lower priority. I will observe, and I'm sure you have as well, our population size, our size city is, in my opinion, a challenging and interesting city in which to develop parking standards. We are not big enough to have such a robust transit system where a lot of these transit-oriented developments ideas work very well. We are certainly still have a strong affection to large trucks, but yet, you know, we'll probably see these Uber-type businesses move in as well. So that's going to be an interesting thing to look at moving forward, electric cars as well. So I'm very interested in your discussion. I think we're getting honed in on some of the areas. I will say when we bring back the housing element, for example, you can look at it with fresh eyes when you're thinking about parking. The housing element will be pushing. That's the place in the general plan that's going to push housing, push density, push land use efficiency to enable our fair share of housing. As we've been seeing this kind of smaller lot, we want to, you know, fit our fair share of housing in. We want to make different housing types available to folks who want to live in the community. And that is going to have consequences on parking. Indeed, by state law, you can actually, if you have an affordable housing project, you can ask for a concession on parking. So state recognizes overparking is an obstacle to the provision of housing. You know, cities are, you know, struggling with how to fit this in our policy documents. So you pointed out a few, and I know there's a few others in our different elements of our general plan. We got the land use elements policy, I think, was pointed out, that talks to allowing kind of off-street shared parking. If you're next to transit or if you're in a mixed-use district, these are tools commonly used everywhere. You know, have we grown enough? Have we grown into them yet here? I'm not so sure. You know, I'm hearing from you that it's certainly not working. I think some data that we'll be able to generate will be useful as well to kind of lend, you know, some hard data to your observations where parking is spilling over, for example, and maybe some of our smaller lot residential districts. But what I anticipate coming back to you is, you know, an alternative to change a policy, which absolutely this is a forum to do this. We can talk about that and make a recommendation to City Council, and we'll give the pros and cons. The pros will be people can park closer to where they want to be. The cons are going to be reduced land use efficiency, perhaps. It's going to be potential impact to housing. We've got to be very careful with housing and our housing element in HCD. Certainly, we don't want to get stopped if we change too many of our housing policies to that would perhaps be perceived by the state as putting in obstacles to affordable housing or infill housing. So we'll have to be very careful there. We could certainly point out those potential areas for you. So I think it's timely, actually. We're looking at our housing element and we're looking at our parking standards concurrently. There'll be, you know, Commissioner Keene's just do something. It certainly we can. We'll bring lots of alternatives to you. Several, I think, are going to be kind of the hard choice. You know, we'll have to make some hard choices.
One of the things that just came to mind was on these small lots where they don't have the parking because they want to build on every inch of the land. Maybe if they want that small lot, maybe they ought to have a smaller house instead of these.
Yep, that's a very good observation. We have gone to a market size home of 2,000 square feet, and is that appropriate for a very small lot? Sure.
Here's another thing, if you can maybe come back with us to information. I know that the state and the state mandate, if you do a particular housing product, there are incentives, and you can overwrite the local building codes regarding setbacks, density, and parking. If you can let us know what that is as well. Because even though we might say you need to provide 2 stalls per unit, the state, if they propose a certain project, may kick it back down to 1 or 1.5. So we just want to make the Planning Commission aware of that.
Certainly.
And one of the thoughts that I have as well is I think that there needs to be a balancing act, and my hope would be is that we come up with some with a set of recommendations or guidelines or rules and regs, whatever, however that ends up looking, that are more reasonable and that are more attainable. But I also, at some level, because in the conversations I've had with friends and neighbors, is that the economic reality and the vehicle per capita reality today is very different from what it was 20 years ago. And, so the size of this residential development and the nature of people parking, the number of people going out to eat in utilizing restaurants is very different today than it was 20 years ago. So there's a higher intensity of travel today than there was 20 years ago. And at some level, we all need to accept the fact that all of our vehicles are not going to be parked off street every single night, whether it's a commercial vehicle or a residential. So, part of this, my hope is we can generate some healthy public discussion, if nothing more. Then, to me, part of this process needs to be educating the public on the reality of, I want to be able to park my car on my driveway and use my garage for my own junk, and anybody that thinks differently be damned type of attitude. So my hope is just let's make our reality a little more current. But there's parking needs and driving needs and commercial vehicle needs are different today, and we just need to come up with something that's more attainable or reasonable and balanced.
I'm going to throw one more thought out as you're talking. As you're talking, I've been working with a residential developer for many years in one of my previous jobs, and it was just like, well, we've got to have a three-car garage. You've got to provide that option. Well, at what point, at what caliber home, do you not make that an option anymore? You make it a requirement. I mean, like John said, why put a 5,000-square-foot home on a lot with a two-car garage? It doesn't make sense, especially if you've got 5 or 6 or 8 bedrooms. I mean, at some particular point, you need to require another on-site parking place in addition to a two-car garage. It's already being done. The developer's already providing it. But maybe we need to look at what triggers that.
I have one more comment. and it's just a comment that... I mean, we already have this parking shortage in the downtown and residential and commercial and industrial, too, because it's on. But yet we continue to approve more projects with the lower density on the parking. When does it stop? And, how are we going to keep accommodating it when we keep approving it when we can't accommodate it now? So we do need to either increase the parking or cut back on the development or don't give the relaxed parking standards.
I don't intend to cut back on any development, but I do want to try to adjust the parking. Like Glenn said, we need to find a balancing act and just make it more palatable for the business, the developers, the people that have to live there. That's the sad part. People buy these houses and don't see far enough ahead of what problems they're going to get into. And so I just think we need some adjustments and some thought about the direction we want to go. And that was my whole goal, is to just try to update our policies in some way to make it so business can do their business and people can live a happy, sheltered life. Okay. Does staff have any questions for us?
Okay, I think we have direction. And we'll follow the schedule as outlined. If anybody has any thoughts along the way, feel free to provide those to staff, and we'll compile them and bring them forward.
I have one question for staff. Because I did read in the language here that there is a mechanism for some projects to pay in lieu fees if they don't provide the parking. Has, I don't want to get on the policy issues because that's city council. Have we collected in lieu fees? Do we have a pot of in lieu fees? And where I was going with that, maybe that's the vehicle to pay for the study for parking and what to do with the cars.
We do have one parking district, and we've developed an in lieu fee associated with the village area, and we did an assessment of the cost of the land that would be required to park, and it's about $24,000, at least when it was done back a few years ago, and that's the in lieu parking fee. We don't have a district anywhere outside of the village as of now. In lieu fees are a good tool. And then, as to your question, is funding of this study, we are pretty slim on contract funds. We'll, if you guys are okay with a little less glamorous, glitzy study, we're okay with that. We can provide that to you. And if the commission would like something a little more robust after seeing that, then we can, you know, pursue other options.
I'm personally not in favor of going out to contract for this. Even if it takes us longer to do it, I think it's a problem that needs solved, and the city's got a lot of other problems too that need money spent on. Any other comments?
No.
Okay. We'll move on to administrative decisions. Is there any questions? May I have any questions? You can't have one.
I was just going to say, I don't think I can.
Item 11, commission communications. Any comments from the Planning Commission?
Actually, I saw a new list here, memorandum from Teresa McGlish on date January 19th for ARC meetings and HRC meetings, and just that's for this new calendar year.
I noticed on this new listing that they have me scheduled for July 4th at ARC. So I think I either don't have to come or...
You go to that one.
She needs to change that
Thank
one.
You, Parker.
I think you'll be the only one there, so we'll move that one.
You know, I can voice my opinion. Do I need to address my... Or do you want to finish with that notice of administrative decision? And then I have comments on commissions that I attended this week.
Okay. You can do that now.
Do it now?
Yes.
Okay. And I was at the HRC, and with regards to two items, which was the, I don't know what they're calling it now, the restaurant here, the Mason Bar and...
Mason Grill.
No, it's not Grill now, it's Mason, what is it? Mason Bar and...
Bar and Kitchen.
And Kitchen.
Kitchen, yeah.
Yeah, they've changed the name. That one, and about the redesign of the exterior elevation on the windows across the front to be consistent with, I don't know, you want to hear all of this? Is this,
sure.
Okay.
As long as there's no discussion.
No, but just inform them. Windows across the front where Roberts used to be consistent with the Bar and Grill, plus wrap around the corner. And I think we did finally approve that it got wrapped around the corner. Am I right? I mean, there was discussion back and forth about that. And anyway, the other one was on the hotel. They came back with a redesign, which will be moving forward to us. It'll look 100 or 200% better than it had in the past. So that was, you know, a great encouragement on that one. The other one was, meeting I went to, was the East Branch revitalization or landscape design plan, and that's where some issues came up about parking for the Paulding Circle area already being deficient, so they're working trying to resolve the redesign for the bike trail in addition to center line medians and not lose any more parking than they already have because they're already short. So I think that will be coming forward here. I don't know. What's the time frame on that? Do you know?
On the East Branch Streetscape Plan, you had the second stakeholders meeting. I think April is our third meeting, so it won't reach the commission level probably till
in summer.
Yeah, probably early summer. Yeah.
Maybe after school is out. We solved that traffic issue. And that was it.
Okay. Any other plan commission comments?
No more? I had a question for staff.
I've got a comment.
Okay.
And a comment request or observation. We have a relatively short time period between receiving our packets on Friday and our meetings on Tuesday. And I don't know, one of my concerns on the agenda tonight is the lack of public attendance. I'm wondering if that is also because of a fairly short time. And I don't know whether that's the city policy is a Friday, Tuesday. There's only 3 or 4 days that are there. But kind of piggyback or part of that would be nice. And I don't know how to do that informally and be in compliance with public laws and ordinances and things of that nature. But it'd be nice to kind of be hinted about the pipeline and kind of what's coming down. Not that, this is going to be a point of discussion tonight type of thing, but, even on this, on the parking stuff, being handed on Friday afternoon of a 3-day weekend, here's this reading and here's that reading and here's this other material and here's this inch and a half of paperwork. It'd be nice to have 4 days rather than three or seven or something along that way. And here again, I recognize that's a change and I don't want to make a big issue out of something that's not a big issue. But if we know there are things coming down the pipeline, it'd be nice if there's a mechanism that we can be given some either background documents or reminders saying, hey, get into CEQA because this is going to be a CEQA issue or potentially could be a CEQA issue. Or, here's, some of the just support documents that may be readily available on some of these things. So we have more than just 3 or 4 days to be reviewing some of this stuff. For me, this particular weekend, it was really difficult to put the whole thing together. So I'm sitting there going, let's delay this till next time type of attitude. And that's not the type of position I want to be able to take. So take that under consideration. Thank you.
I'm certainly happy to. We do try to get, we do make efforts to get the packet out earlier, and it seems like it always comes out. Many times we get it out on Thursday. But we'll certainly be happy to redouble our efforts in that regard. And the reminders and pipeline, certainly we can do to some extent, at least tentative agenda items at the meeting before. So we'll certainly do that under staff communications. This evening, we did recognize that, didn't ask for action items this evening, wanted to kind of roll some of these things out, allow you some time to look at it and think about it. We'll have hopefully some participation by the next meeting when we review these things. So, yeah, thank you.
I had a question along that lines. When does the agenda become an agenda? Is it the Friday before, or is it on a Tuesday or a Wednesday? Is there a cutoff for the agenda? Because maybe it might be as simple as emailing us the agenda a week in advance, so we know what's coming up.
Yeah, the agenda is posted on the Friday before, and that's in accordance with the Brown Act. We can give a tentative agenda that could change. We can certainly do that.
If you're looking at your HRC and ARC agendas, which are usually a couple of 2-3 weeks before it gets to the Planning Commission. So if you're looking at those agendas even online, you can kind of predict what items are going to move forward to Planning Commission. I agree, like the traffic study and element that gets revised, that's not going to be on there, but just like tonight, it just came as a discussion item. So we still have a couple of weeks even review that packet. But I find it interesting to go online and look to see what items are coming at ARSC and HRC. I may not be attending that one, but I just want to know, you know, what's happening in the neighborhood. I guess historically I've done that for 29 years, so like, old habits are hard to break. So that was my comment.
Matt, do you have something?
I was going to piggyback on the HRC ARC comment. You know, as always, we do have a unique feature on our city website called Notify Me. You can actually sign up to be notified when those agendas get posted, so that you can review them. I take every opportunity to alert people to that feature. It's the easiest way for us to disseminate information, and if you just look at it real briefly and see what's on there, it's just at least a good heads up of what's going on.
That's how I get it.
Okay, now a little upbeat. I really appreciate the PG&E installation of the LED lighting. I think it's when I look out, I have a street that runs directly into my house. I can see four blocks, and I can see white lights instead of the dingy, uninviting yellow lights, and it makes you feel better to see them. It makes it look cleaner, and I think it is a huge improvement for the city, let alone the cost of the things. And I think I heard a comment at the last city council meeting that they are in the process of trying to change the ones that the city owns too. And I think that I suggested that some time ago, but now I think that probably with PG&E buying a million of them, or however many they're going to buy statewide, they ought to come at a pretty cheap price, and we may be able to piggyback in with them to get the lights that we need. And I think it's a huge improvement. It just makes you, it looks cleaner out when I look down the street. Okay. Anything else? If not, I'll have a motion for adjournment.
So moved.
Yes.
Second.
Aye, aye, aye.